Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Well, there are few books that are more a part of common cultural reference, I guess we could say, than A Christmas Carol. Whether it's Bah Humbug or God Bless Us, Everyone, or maybe it's the image of Tiny Tim or one of the Christmas ghosts, it's given us a lot, and we're going to learn a lot more about the context that Dickens wrote it in, and what we can learn when we read between the lines. Michael Patrick Hearn is an American literary scholar, one of America's leading men of letters, specializing in children's literature and its illustration. His works include The Annotated Wizard of Oz, The Annotated Huckleberry Finn, and The Annotated Christmas Carol. That's what we're going to be talking about today. His book, The Annotated Christmas Carol. With us by a phone, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Somebody, I'm sure, is wondering, what is an annotated version of a book?
I just had that question earlier today.
You did?
Yes. Annotated just means that it's a critical edition. You have the text of the original book plus notes in the margin to explain various words, phrases, origins of ideas that were Charles Dickens or L. Frank Baum's or Mark Twain's. It's that sort of, the background story of the original book.
And it really adds so much. It's really fascinating. Why did you decide to do one for A Christmas Carol?
Well, I grew up with Dickens. My father read A Christmas Carol to us when we were children, and I just love the story. And it's as much a part of my Christmas as anyone else's. And I just felt there must be more to it than just the story of Scrooge and Marley and the three ghosts.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You wrote that. I've got a quote here somewhere. Oh, here it is. Few modern readers realize that A Christmas Carol was written during a decline in the old Christmas traditions.
Well, Charles Dickens actually defined our modern concept of what Christmas is. Before that, English Puritanism had pretty much suppressed the old traditions of England, Christmas traditions. And even in Dickens' own time, Christmas wasn't celebrated the same way that it is today. In that you didn't have quite the same kind of the kind of festivity, the kind of, it was also considered primarily a religious holiday. So mm-hmm. a lot of the British did not really indulge in Christmas as we do today. And of course, it's become such a bigger event since Dickens' own day.
Our guest today, Michael Patrick Hearn, American literary scholar and author of The Annotated Christmas Carol, illustrated also wonderful illustrations in the book as well. And I'm John Leach, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Did the illustrations for the book. So looking for your comments, are you a fan of A Christmas Carol? What appeals to you about it? Maybe you have some questions about the historical context of the book. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. You say that the American writer Washington Irving actually had a lot to do with the revival of English Christmas traditions. How was that?
Well, Irving had actually written a series of articles about Christmas celebrations, the old Christmas celebrations when he went back to England. And Irving had enormous impact on Charles Dickens. In fact, Dickens, when he came to the United States in 1842, actually met Irving. And you can see a lot of the influence of certainly Irving's style, his point of view, in Dickens' work as well.
And Dickens was a big fan of Washington Irving, you say.
Mm-hmm.
What was the trajectory of Dickens' career leading up to A Christmas Carol?
Well, when he wrote A Christmas Carol, he's probably the most famous writer in the world. He had already written Oliver Twist, The Pickwick Papers, Nicholas Nickleby. Actually, when the season he was working on A Christmas Carol, it came to him in a burst of inspiration. He was working on one of his later novels, Martin Chuzzlewit, and it wasn't selling very well. And he was feeling panicky about it. Was he losing his audience? What was he going to do? How was he going to continue to support himself and his family? And he got the idea of A Christmas Carol, the idea of a Christmas book. He really wanted to seize the imagination of his reading public and produced it in only a few weeks. He also paid for the publication. He paid for the plates. He paid for the printing. He paid for the binding. All the costs came back to him because he thought if he paid for it himself, he'd probably get a larger percentage. But he spent so much money on the production, he actually didn't see a profit until a year later.
Oh, my goodness.
Enormously successful. Well, he also wanted to keep the price down. The first edition was printed in cloth, stamped cloth. It had yellow end papers. It had hand-colored etchings, several wood engravings. It had gold leaf at the top of the pages. It was enormously expensive to produce, and Dickens, absorbed all the costs. So those were deducted from his royalties. So the book was not that successful the first year. Also, it was pirated, and Dickens' work had always been pirated. Up to this point, he thought, since he had such an investment in it, he had to take action, and he sued the pirates. They claimed bankruptcy. He won the case but lost the war because he hadn't had to pay the court costs. So in a sense, Christmas Carol, even though it was enormously successful in terms of the sales, it was not profitable to Dickens for at least a year.
Oh, man. Well, it's certainly an interesting story. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in with comments and questions for you today, Michael. And let's turn to Melissa in Milwaukee now. Melissa, hi. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you both for this fascinating subject. I told your screen caller, I read Christmas Carol at least 2 to 3 times per year, if not more. It's like going on a retreat for me because the story of redemption and transformation is so powerful. I absolutely love it. It's like going on a retreat.
Oh, a great comment from you, Michael.
Well, when I was a child, my father read it to us, and that's where I was introduced to Christmas Carol. And what's quite extraordinary is that the power of the words of the story. I've seen productions, I've seen movies, I've seen theatrical musicals, all these things, but I've never been more profoundly inspired by the story than listening to somebody reading A Christmas Carol. And Dickens wrote it to be read aloud. He really felt that this was a story that should be shared within the family. One of my great experiences was to listen to Christmas Carol being read on the same spot where Dickens read it in New York City, read by Roger Rees, who won the Academy Award, not the, the Emmy Award for, a Tony Award, sorry, Tony Award for Nicholas Nickleby. And it was just an enormously electric experience.
Oh, man. Melissa.
Me who's read it so many times, I'm stunned. Every time I read it, I still cry through it.
And there's always something new in it.
Just that powerful, right?
Yes.
Just that powerful of a writer. So I look forward to reading your annotated copy. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And Penny in Sheboygan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. Yeah. I don't know if you know it, but last night on the radio, PBS radio, and the old time radio show, and that had its rendition with Orson Welles as the master of the show, and it's on every year, and so far I have listened to it every year, and I haven't missed it, but I love the Orson's Well and the version, old-time radio version, the lights off and that, and it's like you're actually there experiencing it with Scrooge, and it just really, and I accidentally found old time radio. I was messing around in that, and I have been an avid listener every Saturday and Sunday since for about 3-4 years.
Oh.
Well, Orson Welles' version is one of the best. We had a recording of Lionel Barrymore reading it on the radio, and that was, you know, I memorized a lot of the passages from Christmas Carol from that recording.
Oh, thank you.
Ever since I found the old time, and that I have not missed Orson Welles. You guys have it every Christmas. You have the radio version of A Christmas Carol, and I hope you continue because I love it, and I have not missed it for the last 4 years since I found
it. All right,
it is one of the best versions.
Penny, thank you so much for calling. Jerry in Argyle, hi.
Hello. I saw a movie that was promoted by Feature Films for Families called The Ghost of Dickens Pass, and I was wondering if the author was familiar with that movie and the validity of any of the claims or how he sees what was displayed there.
The Ghost of Dickens Past? Now, I'm not. Was it a documentary or was it a fictional film?
It's really cool. I think you would enjoy it. It is a story. It's a drama. And I don't remember the actors that are in it, but they portray Dickens as he's struggling, as you had mentioned. His books aren't selling well. He's like, at the end, his wit's end is how he's going to pay his bills.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Well, this was certainly true in 1843 when he came up with the idea of A Christmas Carol.
You know what? I'm going to hold your thoughts for just a minute. We need to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Michael Patrick Hearn, author of The Annotated Christmas Carol. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. No one wants to be called a Scrooge, and I think that really shows the power of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Here we are, more than 150 years after it was published. That name and idea have such a strong connotation. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visiting with Michael Patrick Hearn today, an American literary scholar, one of America's leading men of letters, specializing in children's literature and its illustration. His work that we're talking about today is The Annotated Christmas Carol. And Michael, a great pleasure to have you join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Well, we were visiting before our news break with Jerry and Argyle, who was talking about The Ghost of Dickens, the movie called The Ghost of Dickens, which was really about Dickens' life just before and including the publication of A Christmas Carol. And you were talking about how he really was having some problems with his story selling.
Yes, well, you know, he wrote monthly and then weekly parts. His novels were issued like periodicals, and he was working on Martin Chuzzlewit at the time, and it wasn't selling as well as his earlier novels, and he felt a bit desperate, and he wanted to put out something at Christmas time that'd be very special, and he came up with the concept of A Christmas Carol. And he put it out only a few days before Christmas. I think it was officially released around the 18th or 19th of December. And it was enormously successful. He paid for it himself. He thought he'd get a bigger profit if he paid for all the costs. It was not a financial success. It was a bestseller, but because of the cost of production was so high, those costs had to be eliminated from his early royalty. It was not until a year later that he really made some money off of the book.
Yeah. So, but the initial response to the book was very good.
Yes, it was enormously popular. William Thackeray, probably Dickens' biggest rival as a novelist, wrote a review of it. Thomas Carlyle went out and bought, I think, bought a turkey that Christmas. He was not known for really celebrating Christmas. And it, you know, became enormously popular in the United States. It did not come over to the United States until January 1844 because of, at that point, you really had to wait until the boats came into New York City for books to be delivered. And it was immediately pirated by Harper and Brothers. Also in Philadelphia, it was suddenly appearing in all these different newspapers on the front page. Of course, this was after Christmas. But it became enormously popular in the United States as well.
John in McFarland, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Merry Christmas to you both. I have a recollection of listening to the radio at my grandma's house on Christmas Eve. It was a tradition. Her birthday was that day, and we listened to it. All of us around the radio, and I think Barrymore read all the parts, if I'm not mistaken. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, you're correct. Lionel Barrymore used to read it.
Lionel Barrymore,
almost
yes.
Every Christmas on the radio. He was supposed to play Scrooge in the MGM version of A Christmas Carol, but he wasn't well, and he was replaced by Reginald Owen. I think it's a real shame that Lionel Barrymore, it was never filmed with him as Scrooge.
Yeah.
That would have been wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you, John, for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, if you have a question or a comment or an experience to share relating to A Christmas Carol, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments or email us at talk@WPR.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Don in De Pere emailed us, and he says, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol is not really a story of Christmas. I believe it's a story of love and compassion. Scrooge, never having love or compassion in his youth, finds it in the beautiful Belle. Being unfamiliar with love and its true meaning, he loses Belle, and it's only when he is visited by the three ghosts that love and compassion is awakened in him. Dickens uses the Christmas season to make his story more meaningful.
Well, what's extraordinary about Christmas Carol is Dickens never refers to the Nativity at all in the story. He does not. Well, he does mention it in passing at the Cratchit Christmas celebration, but it's not really necessarily a Christian fable, even though it all takes place during Christmas time. It's really a secular fable.
And his concern for children and a sense that how a society treats its children is very telling and runs throughout the story.
And that's certainly true about his whole career. In fact, he probably wrote the very first novel in which a child was the protagonist, Oliver Twist, and had enormous impact. So many other writers started writing stories about children and what their conditions were. And certainly Tiny Tim is central to the whole theme of A Christmas Carol.
Yeah. And the adults that he holds in high esteem, Bob Cratchit, Scrooge's nephew Fred, and ultimately Scrooge himself, are those that can act in a childlike way.
Exactly. And the beginning of Scrooge's a conversion or a return to humanity, basically, is when he goes back to his own childhood and sees the lonely boy in the schoolroom.
And you point out that, in fact, the children that Scrooge describes are often mature and adult in their thoughts and sentiments.
Well, when you look at Tiny Tim and what he talks about, he sounds so mature. You know, through his illness, he's able to see things that the adults are not able to see. And another important point in the story is that what Scrooge's real sin is that leads to his conversion is when he threatens a child who's singing a Christmas carol. This is when everything starts changing around him. I think this is what really calls up Marley's ghost to change him. It's when he starts threatening a child who's just singing a Christmas carol in the snow.
Yeah, and the ghosts are, of course, really a fascinating aspect of the book. And you point out that it's only the ghost of Christmas present who's an active character who can affect change.
Yes, you cannot change the past. That's clear. But you can change your attitude towards the past or towards... I think the ghost of Christmas past acts as a catalyst to bring out Scrooge's feeling of guilt and past.
You know, I think most of us think of A Christmas Carol as a standalone book, but in fact, Dickens wrote a whole series of Christmas books and Christmas stories.
Yes, Christmas Carol was so successful that for several more years he wrote five Christmas books, one a year. The others are not quite as well known, certainly not as well known as A Christmas Carol. He also wrote a whole series of Christmas stories for the various magazines that he edited, and he was so linked to the whole Christmas spirit that supposedly a little costermonger's girl, when Dickens died, asked, "Will Father Christmas die as well?"
You know, it's rare that a fiction writer can alter his or her work after the fact. But Dickens, in doing public readings of A Christmas Carol right up until his death, as you point out, did just that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dickens was probably the first major writer who went on a public reading tour. The original readings were for charity, and then he went on these tours for his own benefit, for his own profit. He had always wanted to be an actor. He probably would have been an actor had he not developed a cold. He was going to an audition, and he wasn't feeling well, so he didn't do it and didn't return to it. And he started writing his sketches and then his stories and became a famous writer. But he always wanted to be an actor. He was even an amateur actor. He produced a number of amateur plays. But he just loved the audience, being there with his public, with their reaction, seeing how they reacted to his words. And it was enormously successful, but also very fulfilling for the writer himself.
Yeah. What type of changes did he make?
Well, when he did A Christmas Carol, he reduced it and pretty much concentrated on the great set pieces like the Fezziwig Ball, the Cratchit Christmas, those things. It's pretty much the same story, but he cut out a lot of the secondary scenes. And it was the only one of his stories in which he gave almost the complete text. Most of his other readings, for example, from Pickwick, it was the trial from Pickwick, and he would use certain incidents, like the murder of Nancy in Oliver Twist. But Christmas Carol was, you know, a complete piece, a complete story, and it was probably his most popular.
Catherine in Beaver Dam, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
And what's on your mind?
I was calling because I had heard we're doing this radio show. Actually, I'm listening to you in the car right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm listening to you guys on the radio right now in my car. And what brought me on today is when I was in sixth grade, my English teacher had assigned A Christmas Carol as our over the holiday reading assignment, and we had to do a paper on it.
Uh-oh.
And
that's a way to kill kill appreciation.
I never got around to the paper, unfortunately, and I failed the assignment, but it was because I was so engrossed in the story, and I just kept on reading it and reading it and reading it, and I just never got around to writing it. And ever since then, I've been reading it once a year, and I just had a little boy. He's about almost a year old now, and I read it to him last Christmas, and we're going to be reading it to him, me and my fiance, on Christmas Eve tomorrow. And it's just an incredible tradition that I absolutely love and am so grateful for.
Oh, well, I think I I've got to believe, Catherine, given your interest, that you will really enjoy the annotated Christmas carol that Michael Patrick Kern has put together here. I'm sure of that. A comment from you, Michael, about the impact that the book had on Catherine?
Well, you know, I had very much the same influence. I was just so fascinated with the story. But, you know, not all little kids react the same way. In fact, my nieces were scared to death by A Christmas Carol because of all the ghosts. They thought it was a very frightening story when they were very little. I think they have accepted it. But when they were little, it was quite a frightening story.
Oh, no.
Catherine, so that's keep that in mind.
You don't want to scare the kids with Dickens yet.
Thank you very much for calling. Oh, let's take another call here. Stephanie in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there, Larry, and hi to your guests. This is absolutely wonderful. I have really want to read A Christmas Carol now. I've never read the book. I will have to either, since I'm now blind, I have to go to the National Library Service. I have talking books, or find a really good audio book. But I want to comment about the Campbell Playhouse Theater, and I've heard different versions of A Christmas Carol. The one that's played on WPR, Norman Gilliland plays every year, is the one from December 24, 1939, and I've heard that that's the best. I've heard different versions where the script will be somewhat different, so it'll take different parts of the book, but it's basically the same. But there's nobody, I think 1 year Orson Welles played Scrooge because Lionel Barrymore wasn't available or he was sick, but nobody plays Scrooge like Lionel Barrymore. And the one I heard last night, I've heard it every year for years. I never get sick of it. I was in tears last night because Lionel, when he's confronted by the ghost, I mean, he's you guys can say, provide the description for Scrooge, he's a wrenching, whatever, but the adjective's describing him. But he, you know,
A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. I love that. He's one cold man. I mean, somebody comes in wanting to collect money for families, and he's, you know, let these people go to debtor's prison. Let them stew in their own pudding. He's cold.
Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?
Yes, exactly, exactly. By the time he goes through the, he's seeing the kind of man he had become, and he's horrified. And I was in tears last night. I really was.
Well, you know, another wonderful production is Patrick Stewart reading A Christmas Carol. I think that's available on CD or DVD. I saw him doing it live, and it was dynamic.
Oh, wow.
So you should look into that. It's really a wonderful production. He also did a dramatization of A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
But the reading is even better, I think.
Well, I hope your book goes on to audiobook, too, because I would love to know about the annotations. And by the way, what is Smoking Bishop?
It is a drink.
Okay.
And it has wine in it, and that refers to the cloak of a bishop.
Uh-huh. This is just fascinating. I've never gotten tired of the story. It's a wonderful story, and thank you so much, Larry, both of you. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to both of you.
To you as well.
God bless us, everyone.
Yes, thank you, Stephanie. Thank you very much for calling. Let me give the number. If you'd like to join in, maybe you've got a comment or question, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Give a call as we visit with our guest today, Michael Patrick Kern, about his book, The Annotated Christmas Carol. Love to hear from you. Did A Christmas Carol work as a political commentary?
Well, yes, it is. It is very political. But it's not polemical in the sense that some of other Dickens' works are. He really wanted to change a person's character. He wasn't so he didn't say we have to change society, then people will be better. He said if people were better, then society would change. And this is certainly his theory about Scrooge once Scrooge changes, he's able to change things around him. Certainly altering, Tiny Tim lives, Bob Cratchit prospers. He does whatever he can to make Christmas live within him all the year round.
Yeah. Is that an economic commentary?
I think that's part of it, because Scrooge is so interested in money all the time. And I think one of the most telling points is when Scrooge is confronted by Marley's ghost, the ghost of his former partner, and Scrooge says, "Marley, you were always a good man of business." And Marley's response is, "Mankind was my business."
Ah, yeah. You bring out a very interesting point before we go to the phones again. You say that while considering the social content of this Christmas carol in prose, and we did discuss this a bit, but you are struck by how non-religious a Christmas story it is.
Yes.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think I don't think Dickens himself was particularly religious, or he certainly had his beliefs, but he really wanted to capture the British public and really capture what was important to them. He didn't want to lecture to them necessarily, even though he created this fable, this Christmas fable in A Christmas Carol. And he wasn't interested in the fine points of religious discussion. He was really interested in helping people and really really enlivening the spirit of Christmas within them, rather than talking about the birth of Christ and the virgin birth and or this or that, specific things about religious topics. It really wasn't his concern.
What do you think Dickens would make of how we market Christmas today?
Well, I think he would. it's hard to say. I think he would be appalled at some of the things that happen, such as the fights that break out at Walmart and other places during Christmas sales, that sort of thing. I think he would be appalled by that. And just the aggression of selling, I think, is would have been a bit much for him. I think he believed that people should be celebrating with your family and celebrating really the goodness and not the negative aspects of human nature.
It must have been wonderfully interesting to have done this work. Was there something that really surprised you in your research?
Well, I was surprised to learn that Dickens had to sue the pirates right after the piracy of his work right after the book came out. Also, one thing that's very interesting is that as soon as A Christmas Carol came out, there were all these productions, different dramatizations of A Christmas Carol all over England. And at that time, you couldn't copyright the dramatic rights to your work, so anyone could have done A Christmas Carol. And all of these plays were preserved because to have them put on the stage in England, they had to go through the censor board. And all of these were preserved, these different dramatizations of Christmas Carol, and they're all in the British Library now. They've all been transferred to the British Library. And so I found all sorts of references there. They specified certain places that Dickens mentioned in the book and certain traditions and clarified certain things that I would not have known just reading the text, because they reflected what England was like at that time.
Wow. You have a fascinating, fascinating book, and I want to thank you so much for taking time today, Michael, to visit with us about it. It's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you very much, and happy holidays.
To you as well. Michael Patrick Hearn, American literary scholar, and what a wonderful book he has, the Annotated Christmas Carol. I hope you have a chance to look at it. It's quite a fascinating read. Well, tomorrow, Santa Claus visits us, Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus, and we only talk to boys and girls tomorrow. Let them tell us what they want for Christmas. I'm looking forward to that, and I hope you are too. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.